Chapter 5. Speaking of this matter reminds me of many incidents, many things that I could tell, but I think I will not try to do it now. It will be more to my present humor to call back a little glimpse of the simple and colorless good times we used to have in our village homes in those peaceful days, especially in the winter. In the summer we children were out on the breezy uplands with the flocks from dawn till night, and then there was noisy frolicking and all that. But winter was the cozy time, winter was the snug time. Often we gathered in old Jock Dark's big dirt-floored apartment, with a great fire going, and played games, and sang songs, and told fortunes, and listened to the old villagers tell tales and histories and lies, and one thing and another till 12 o'clock at night. One winter's night we were gathered there. It was the winter that for years afterward they called the hard winter, and that particular night was a sharp one. It blew a gale outside, and the screaming of the wind was a stirring sound, and I think I may say it was beautiful, for I think it is great and fine and beautiful to hear the wind rage and storm and blow its clarions like that when you are inside and comfortable. And we were. We had a roaring fire, and the pleasant spit-spit of the snow, and sleet falling in it down the chimney, and the yarning and laughing and singing went on at a noble rate till about 10 o'clock, and then we had a supper of hot porridge and beans, and meal cakes with butter, and appetites to match. Little Joan sat on a box apart, and had her bowl and bread on another one, and her pets around her helping. As he had more than was usual of them or economical, because all the outcast cats came and took up with her, and homeless or unlovable animals of other kinds heard about it and came, and he spread the matter to the other creatures, and they came also. And as the birds and the other timid wild things of the woods were not afraid of her, but always had an idea she was a friend, when they came across her, and generally struck up an acquaintance with her to get invited to the house, she always had samples of those breeds in stock. She was hospitable to them all, for an animal was an animal to her, and dear by mere reason of being an animal, no matter about its sort or social station. And as she would allow of no cages, no collars, no fetters, but left the creatures free to come and go as they liked, that contented them, and they came, but they didn't go, to any extent, and so they were a marvelous nuisance, and made Jock Dark swear a good deal, but his wife said God gave the child the instinct, and knew what he was doing when he did it, therefore it must have its course. It would be no sound prudence to meddle with his affairs, when no invitation had been extended. So the pets were left in peace, and here they were, as I have said, rabbits, birds, squirrels, cats, and other reptiles, all around the child, and full of interest in her supper, and helping what they could. There was a very small squirrel on her shoulder, sitting up, as those creatures do, and turning a rocky fragment of prehistoric chestnut cake over and over in its knotty hands, and hunting for the less indurated places, and giving its elevated bushy tail a flirt, and its pointed ears a toss, when it found one, signifying thankfulness and surprise, and then it filed that place off with those two slender front teeth which a squirrel carries for that purpose and not for ornament, for ornamental they never could be, as any will admit that have noticed them. Everything was going fine and breezy and hilarious, but then there came an interruption, for somebody hammered on the door. It was one of those ragged road stragglers, the eternal wars kept the country full of them. He came in, all over snow, and stamped his feet, and shook, and brushed himself, and shut the door, and took off his limp ruin of a hat, and slapped it once or twice against his leg, to knock off its fleece of snow, and then glanced around on the company with a pleased look upon his thin face, and a most yearning and famished one in his eye, when it fell upon the victuals, and then he gave us a humble and conciliatory salutation, and said it was a blessed thing to have a fire like that on such a night, and a roof overhead like this, and that rich food to eat, and loving friends to talk with. Ah, yes, this was true, and God help the homeless, and such as must trudge the roads in this weather. Nobody said anything. The embarrassed poor creature stood there, and appealed to one face after the other with his eyes, and found no welcome in any, the smile on his own face flickering and fading and perishing meanwhile. Then he dropped his gaze, the muscles of his face began to twitch, and he put up his hand to cover this womanish sign of weakness. Sit down. This thunder blast was from old Jock Dark, and Joan was the object of it. The stranger was startled, and took his hand away, and there was Joan standing before him offering him her bowl of porridge. The man said, God Almighty bless you, my darling. And then the tears came, and ran down his cheeks, but he was afraid to take the bowl. Do you hear me? Sit down, I say. There could not be a child more easy to persuade than Joan, but this was not the way. Her father had not the art, neither could he learn it. Joan said, Father, he is hungry, I can see it. Let him work for food, then. We are being eaten out of house and home by his like, and I have said I would endure it no more, and will keep my word. He has the face of a rascal anyhow, and a villain. Sit down, I tell you. I know not if he is a rascal or no, but he is hungry, father, and shall have my porridge. I do not need it. If you don't obey me, rascals are not entitled to help from honest people, and no bite nor sup shall they have in this house. Joan. She set her bowl down on the box, and came over and stood before her scowling father, and said, Father, if you will not let me, then it must be as you say. But I would, that you would think, then you would see, that it is not right to punish one part of him for what the other part has done. For it is that poor stranger's head that does the evil things, but it is not his head that is hungry, it is his stomach, and it has done no harm to anybody, but is without blame, and innocent, not having any way to do a wrong, even if it was minded to it. Please let, what an idea! It is the most idiotic speech I ever heard. But Aubrey, the mayor, broke in, he being fond of an argument, and having a pretty gift in that regard, as all acknowledged. Rising in his place and leaning his knuckles upon the table, and looking about him with easy dignity, after the manner of such as the orators, he began, smooth and persuasive. I will differ with you there, gossip, and will undertake to show the company here. He looked around upon us, and nodded his head in a confident way that there is a grain of sense in what the child has said. For look you, it is of a certainty most true and demonstrable, that it is a man's head that is master and supreme ruler over his whole body. Is that granted? Will any deny it? He glanced around again. Everybody indicated assent. Very well, then, that being the case, no part of the body is responsible for the result when it carries out an order delivered to it by the head. Ergo, the head is alone responsible for crimes done by a man's hands or feet or stomach. Do you get the idea? Am I right thus far? Everybody said yes, and said it with enthusiasm, and some said, one to another, that the mayor was in great form tonight, and at his very best, which pleased the mayor exceedingly, and made his eyes sparkle with pleasure, for he overheard these things. So he went on in the same fertile and brilliant way. And now, then, we will consider what the term responsibility means, and how it affects the case in point. Responsibility makes a man responsible for only those things for which he is properly responsible, and he waved his spoon around in a wide sweep, to indicate the comprehensive nature of that class of responsibilities which render people responsible, and several exclaimed, admiringly, he is right. He has put that whole tangled thing into a nutshell, it is wonderful. After a little pause, to give the interest opportunity to gather and grow, he went on, colon, very good. Let us suppose the case of a pair of tongs that falls upon a man's foot, causing a cruel hurt. Will you claim that the tongs are punishable for that? The question is answered. I see by your faces that you would call such a claim absurd. Now, why is it absurd? It is absurd because, there being no reasoning faculty, that is to say, no faculty of personal command in a pair of tongs, personal responsibility for the acts of the tongs is wholly absent from the tongs, and, therefore, responsibility being absent, punishment cannot ensue. Am I right? A hearty burst of applause was his answer. And now, then, we arrive at a man's stomach. Consider how exactly, how marvelously, indeed, its situation corresponds to that of a pair of tongs. Listen and take careful note, I beg you. Can a man's stomach plan a murder? No. Can it plan a theft? No. Can it plan an incendiary fire? No. Now answer me, can a pair of tongs? There were admiring shouts of, oh, and the cases are just exact. And don't he do it splendid? Ah, then, friends and neighbors, a stomach which cannot plan a crime cannot be a principal in the commission of it, that is plain, as you see. The matter is narrowed down by that much. We will narrow it further. Can a stomach, of its own motion, assist at a crime? The answer is no, because command is absent, the reasoning faculty is absent, volition is absent, as in the case of the tongs. We perceive now, do we not, that the stomach is totally irresponsible for crimes committed, either in whole or in part, by it. He got a rousing cheer for response. Then what do we arrive at as our verdict? Clearly this, that there is no such thing in this world as a guilty stomach, that in the body of the veriest rascal resides a pure and innocent stomach, that, whatever its owner may do, it at least, should be sacred in our eyes, and that while God gives us minds to think just, and charitable and honorable thoughts, it should be, and is, our privilege, as well as our duty, not only to feed the hungry stomach that resides in a rascal, having pity for its sorrow and its need, but to do it gladly, gratefully, in recognition of its sturdy and loyal maintenance of its purity and innocence in the midst of temptation and in company so repugnant to its better feelings. I am done. Well, you never saw such an effect. They rose, the whole house rose, and clapped, and cheered, and praised him to the skies, and one after another, still clapping and shouting, they crowded forward, some with moisture in their eyes, and wrung his hands, and said such glorious things to him, that he was clear overcome with pride and happiness, and couldn't say a word, for his voice would have broken, sure. It was splendid to see. And everybody said he had never come up to that speech in his life before, and never could do it again. Eloquence is a power, there is no question of that. Even old Jock Dark was carried away, for once in his life, and shouted out, "It's all right, Joan, give him the porridge." She was embarrassed, and did not seem to know what to say, and so didn't say anything. It was because as he had given the man the porridge long ago, and he had already eaten it all up. When she was asked why as he had not waited until a decision was arrived at, she said the man's stomach was very hungry, and it would not have been wise to wait, since she could not tell what the decision would be. Now that was a good and thoughtful idea for a child. The man was not a rascal at all. He was a very good fellow, only he was out of luck, and surely that was no crime at that time in France. Now that his stomach was proved to be innocent, it was allowed to make itself at home, and as soon as it was well filled and needed nothing more, the man unwound his tongue, and turned it loose, and it was really a noble one to go. He had been in the wars for years, and the things he told, and the way he told them fired everybody's patriotism away up high, and set all hearts to thumping, and all pulses to leaping. Then, before anybody rightly knew how the change was made, he was leading us a sublime march through the ancient glories of France, and in fancy we saw the titanic forms of the 12 paladins rise out of the mists of the past and face their fate. We heard the tread of the innumerable hosts sweeping down to shut them in. We saw this human tide flow and ebb, ebb, and flow, and waste away before that little band of heroes. We saw each detail pass before us of that most stupendous, most disastrous, yet most adored, and glorious day in French legendary history. Here and there and yonder, across that vast field of the dead and dying, we saw this and that and the other paladin dealing his prodigious blows with weary arm and failing strength, and one by one we saw them fall, till only one remained, he that was without peer, he whose name gives name to the Song of Songs, the song which no Frenchman can hear, and keep his feelings down and his pride of country cool. Then, grandest and pitifulest scene of all, we saw his own pathetic deed, and out stillness, as we sat with parted lips and breathless, hanging upon this man's words, gave us a sense of the awful stillness that reigned in that field of slaughter, when that last surviving soul had passed. And now, in this solemn hush, the stranger gave Joan a pat or two on the head and said, "Little maid, whom God keep, you have brought me from death to life this night. Now listen. Here is your reward, and at that supreme time for such a heart-melting, soul-rousing surprise," without another word he lifted up the most noble and pathetic voice that was ever heard, and began to pour out the great song of Roland. Think of that, with a French audience all stirred up and ready. Oh, where was your spoken eloquence now? What was it to this? How fine he looked, how stately, how inspired, as he stood there with that mighty chant welling from his lips and his heart, his whole body transfigured, and his rags along with it. Everybody rose and stood while he sang, and their faces glowed and their eyes burned, and the tears came and flowed down their cheeks, and their forms began to sway unconsciously to the swing of the song, and their bosoms to heave and pant. And moanings broke out, and deep ejaculations. And when the last verse was reached, and Roland lay dying, all alone, with his face to the field, unto his slain, lying there in heaps and windrows, and took off and held up his gauntlet to God with his failing hand, and breathed his beautiful prayer with his paling pips, all burst out in sobs and wailings. But when the final great note died out and the song was done, they all flung themselves in a body at the singer, stark mad with love of him, and love of France and pride in her great deeds and old renown, and smothered him with their embracings. But Joan was there first, hugged close to his breast, and covering his face with idolatrous kisses. The storm raged on outside, but that was no matter. This was the stranger's home now, for as long as he might please. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.